ऐसी मशीन लगाऊंगा, इस साइड से आलू घुसेगा, उस साइड से सोना निकलेगा।
Everybody, welcome to this episode of the Attention Please podcast. So this week Vikram is not here, so I'm back to doing things alone. And I know when I say the word doing things alone, it reminds me of my Jadavpur University days. But no matter what, it's a little odd actually, now that I realize it, that even in a podcast where there is somebody else, it actually feels a lot more natural. Even though that person might not be saying a lot, but the very fact that there's somebody at the other end of the line makes it slightly more natural for me. When there's nobody else and I'm kind of recording alone, it's somewhat disconcerting, I would say. So I personally prefer talking to somebody, even if that person isn't saying anything, because it's just so much easier to at least pretend that there's a conversation going on. Here it's like very unnatural. So anyways, just thought I would say that. So the topics that I wanted to do today. So first thing was yesterday I saw Deepakar Banerjee's Sandeep or Pinky Farah, which, I mean, it was a huge fan of Deepakar Banerjee when he made Khosla Ka Khosla, which I still think is one of the best Hindi movies ever made, in the sense that it's perfect as a comedy. And over the years, he's of course been one of the better movie makers. Some people might consider him to be the best, but I wouldn't call him the best. I would possibly put him at the top three Hindi movie makers that are currently making movies. And he's, I would say, consistently disappointed me, at least in some of his last outings. I mean, Bomkesh Bokshi, which I still think is his worst work, was absolutely terrible. And Sandeep or Pinky Farah is, of course, much better than Bomkesh Bokshi. But it still left, at least for me, a lot to be, it wasn't what I felt that it would be. And it started off extremely promisingly. That first sequence, and I don't want to spoil it for those who haven't seen it because there's kind of a surprise in it. That first sequence was just classic Deepakar. And so once it started, my expectations within the first 7 or 8 minutes went sky high. And then the rest of the movie was basically a long, long anticlimax. And first of all, I think the movie was a little bit too long. Second is, I mean, Deepakar's strength is when he focuses on middle-class North Indian families. He's not particularly Bengali, even though he has a Banerjee at the end of his name. So I don't think he does Bengal that well. I mean, he did, Bomkesh Bokshi was pathetic. It was a very stylized Bengal, and it had no relation. Bomkesh Bokshi, as was shown in the movie, Bomkesh Bokshi had as much to do with Bengal as if you set something in Las Vegas or something else. In Bengal, Calcutta was just like, here's Calcutta, but it had nothing to do with Calcutta or Bengal, definitely not in the 1940s. So it was, in a way, history deaf, I would say. And when you go into a movie like that and you're setting it in the 1940s, you expect that it be true to history, and it should look like what we know Bengal in the 1940s was. And then I kept thinking, and again, I don't want to go back to Bomkesh Bokshi, but I think it was a terrible movie overall. Definitely terrible when you compare it with what we know Deepakar Banerjee can do. But coming back to Sandeep or Pinky Farah, it's best when Deepakar is on solid ground, which is middle-class North Indian families. So whenever the focus of the story is that, it's a great movie. It's very entertaining. But that's possibly 20% of the movie. Most of the 80% of the movie is about Arjun Kapoor and Parineeti Chopra. And that story, the main story for me, didn't work at all. it was, and I understood where Dibakar and Varun Grover were coming from. I understood they were trying to subvert some of the tropes, but you know, this is a line that even I, as a story writer, sometimes it's a difficult line to navigate, because on one hand you want to give people something fresh, something new, but on the other hand you also want to subvert expectations. Like when I write a Sultan of Delhi and you know market it as a political thriller, if then people pick it up and find that it's a comedy, then I possibly have subverted the trope, but is that something which was particularly what's desired is something else. Because one of the things with any movie and slotting it into any genre is that you have people walking in with certain expectations. And Sandeep or Pinky Farrar actually raises that expectation in the first 7 minutes. It starts off as a, you know, fairly conventional and I would say very well done thriller. So the first 7 minutes are perfect. But then it meanders into, and I knew that this was Divakar Banerjee, so you know, we would want to see some of the Dibakarisms. We would like to see some quirky middle-class Indian characters, some Uncle G's and aunties, and they were all there. But it's the focus is purely on the main story, and it's just long, and I understand that they're trying to subvert the tropes with respect to everything, even the gender of the names, they're turned around, and you know, and I get it. But sometimes this is what happens, and this is not the only time I felt that. One of the biggest critiques I have of Mrinal Sen as a director was precisely this, that sometimes he became so obsessed with the message. In the case of Mrinal Sen, it was communism, that you know, he just forgot to make a good movie. And Mrinal Sen's best movies are movies in which he puts politics on the back burner, or at least to the side, and makes a human story. He's a very good movie director when he can do that. But when he can't do that, he's just his ideology kept coming in. And it seemed to be like he was making a propaganda movie. So many of his works are kind of damned by the propaganda element of it. And he I believe is, you know, after Satyajit Ray, I would put him as, if he hadn't done that, I would have definitely put him as the best Bengali movie director after Satyajit Ray. But because of, you know, a large amount of his output being essentially political movies, he wasn't particularly, it was very overt, very ham-handed, very poking your eye in it. There was nothing subtle. And I'm pretty sure that Mrinal Sen and his fans would say, but communist movies aren't supposed to be subtle. But, okay, all right. Anyways, so the problem with Sandeep or Pinky Farrar is it just tries too hard. And I believe it takes the audience for granted. So I was hoping that it would either be a thriller or be a dark comedy. In the end, it was nothing. It was, you know, deeply unsatisfying. And, you know, the movie ended and you wondered, and it's not that I was expecting a romance or anything of that sort. But I mean, I'm the last person to expect romance, but it just didn't work for me. I thought that the two main characters, perhaps the acting was perhaps what was off with respect to the two characters. And Parinithi Chopra tries hard. She has some very good scenes. Arjun Kapoor is just terrible, for the want of a better word, just terrible throughout. I mean, he has this one same expression on his face throughout, this, you know, clueless, puzzled expression. And I think he's the major letdown. I think Parinithi Chopra tries her best, but it's also that, you know, in terms of the writing, I expected the writing to be much, much better. There were places in which there were definitely pacing issues. Definitely there could have been, this movie could have done with 20 minutes more of edits without losing anything. It would have been much more focused. And I'm pretty sure that the Dibakar would have been able to convey whatever message or whatever subversion of tropes that he was going for, even with that. Anyways, moving forward with COVID, I mean, I didn't lead with COVID because I think we have been leading with COVID most of the times over the last few weeks. And again, there is nothing new as of this last week. It continues to be terrible in India. And honestly, given the fact that the administration didn't do anything for the year, it's kind of unrealistic to expect that anything of significance could happen within a week or within a month. And now we have I guess nobody saw this coming, the proliferation of black fungus, and now I hear even white fungus. And there was a black and white joke I would have made. If you remember, there was an Anil Kapoor movie, which I'm not going to make because of the seriousness of this topic. But, you know, this is in a way, and we use this has become a cliche, like out of the box, the word perfect storm. So in India, the fact that there is diabetes has been an epidemic for so long, kind of been a silent epidemic in the sense that the number of people who know they are diabetic is vastly outnumbered by the number of people who don't know they're diabetic. And this curious notion of, well, I'm pre-diabetic, my sugar is a little high. You know, all of these things combine. And the thing about diabetes is that it's, for most people, unless they're severely diabetic, it's not something which you live with every day. It's not that, you know, and type 1 diabetics, you know, the symptoms are very obvious. That's why type 1 diabetics usually have much better control, because if you don't have control, you will feel the effect in your daily life. With type 2 diabetics, that's not true. So the effect of diabetes, you know, take decades before it really hits. And so there is really no, I mean, unless you take your blood glucose readings regularly, there is no really outward manifestation. And most people with type 2 diabetes don't usually have like uncontrollable thirst, or so they don't have any external manifestations, or, you know, wounds not healing. I mean, those are really late stage diabetes complications. They're not usually, even people who have diabetes, let's say in the 20s and 30s, they will not experience those things. But something like black fungus, you know, that brings all of it out. I mean, it doesn't depend on your external manifestations. For those of you who haven't been following the story, many people who have kind of recovered from COVID-19 are now falling prey to black fungus, which is in a way even worse than COVID-19, because this topic is so serious, I don't want to appear facetious here, but, you know, with losing your life or losing your eyes or losing, I really don't know which one's worse. People are losing their lives to black fungus also. So what happens with black fungus is that, and not just black fungus, white fungus, there are a lot of bacteria that live in, that we are kind of used to in India. And normally they live among us, we live among them in a state of, you know, I wouldn't say happy equilibrium, but kind of, there is a kind of ceasefire between us. And then when something like this happens, when COVID-19 happens, what's happening is that in order to, for those of you who, I'm not a doctor, so what I'm going to say might not be fully accurate, but what really happens with treatment of COVID-19, I mean, where the complications of COVID-19 actually start, is that I read this in a New Yorker article a long time ago, which I think explained it very well, was that the main thing, the main killer thing about COVID-19, what makes it different from your garden variety flu. Otherwise, there's nothing really different in terms of its effect. So most people, as doctors have now realized within a year, don't really die from COVID-19. They die for your body's reaction to COVID-19. So whether the COVID-19's main trick, the trick it pulls to, because one thing that you have to understand is an effective virus needs to be, it cannot kill its host. So for its own purpose, for its own genetic purpose, for its own Darwinistic purpose, it needs to ensure that the host doesn't die. The best example is the herpes virus, which lives for years, forever in human beings. It doesn't kill them. I mean, there are some people have outbreaks of herpes, but it's not life-threatening. It's painful for those who have it, but it's not life-threatening. So the virus lives for years, for decades, and it has a happy equilibrium with its host. With COVID, in a way, it's not a particularly good virus because it, you know, so technically it is good because, you know, 1% of people with perhaps COVID die, but COVID infects pretty much everybody in a population. So 1% is still a, you know, huge number. But coming back to the interaction, for those of you who haven't been following the literature, is that what happens is with COVID, after you recover from COVID or while you're recovering from COVID, when your body produces antibodies to fight the COVID-infected cells. The trick about COVID is it kind of camouflages itself genetically with the rest of your body. So when the antibodies come, the cytokine storm, it cannot distinguish between the infected cells and your body's own cells. So it just starts destroying everything in your body, in whichever area is infected. And so when it starts destroying everything, and that's really where COVID-19, SARS-CoV-2 differs from conventional, you know, flu viruses, is that flu doesn't do this part. This is special. So what it does is your body, your immune system cannot recognize infected cells and healthy cells. So your body basically burns everything, even the ones that it didn't need to kind of burn. When I say burn, it's there's air quotes here. And what happens is that because of this, there are basically the dead bodies of your cells block up your blood. It makes your blood clot, that is kind of not flow as smoothly as it should. It basically allows for deoxygenated blood to accumulate. That's really when your SpO2 levels start going down because, you know, you're, as all of us know, basic biology, your blood circulates, it goes to the alveoli where, you know, deoxygenated blood, oxygenated blood, they exchange. You know, your blood gets oxygenated and it flows back again. Well, that depends on a certain flow of blood. If your blood is kind of, the flow is decreasing because of clots, which are essentially impediments to its flow, then you're not going to be able to get rid of your used oxygen. Your deoxygenated blood is not going to be purified into oxygenated blood at the level that you need in order to live a healthy life, in order for your organs to get its oxygen. This is why your SpO2, your blood oxygen starts decreasing. That's when you know that your COVID infection has, you know, it's, you're in danger at that point of time. So the treatment that doctors have used is, you know, they've used blood thinners essentially to compensate for the decrease in the flow of blood by making it more watery, essentially. And the other thing that it is that the doctors have figured out is the use of steroids. And what steroids does is it basically reduces your body's immune response. It holds it back. It weakens your body's immune response because, as we said, it's not COVID isn't the problem. It's your body destroying your other cells that is the problem. So even if that reduces your body's response against COVID-19, COVID-19 by itself isn't particularly virulent. So that seems to be a good strategy, except that's where the black fungus comes in a place like India, where, you know, you have these bacteria living in close contact with human beings, usually at a state of equilibrium. The moment your defenses go down, that's when these bacteria know, this is now what doctors call an opportunistic infection. Now the bacteria sees, hey, this guy has no longer any defenses. The doors and windows are open. Let's just walk in right now. And that's what is leading to this black fungus. Now, with diabetics, the problem is that they don't heal as fast as normal people who have their blood sugars controlled. So that enables internal infections to fester, and the spread of the black fungus is much more severe in diabetic patients. So it's not that non-diabetic patients are not getting infected. It's also people who are recovering from cancer. People with compromised immune systems are just getting it with the black fungus. And again, this is a side effect, not so much of COVID-19, but the use of steroids, which is why many doctors are saying, don't use steroids willy-nilly. Let's just reduce the risk of, like, let's use steroids for people who actually are at a stage where their blood is clotting, rather than use it as a general protocol that, hey, if you test positive for COVID-19, just give them steroids so that the disease does not progress to the next stage. Now doctors are saying, let's do it if we find that the disease is progressing to the next stage. Again, I'm not a doctor, so I might not be 100% scientifically accurate, but based on what I've been reading, this is really what I've gleaned. So that's, again, it's kind of scary, and I think the point comes to that. The larger point is obviously the fact that we in India haven't invested in public health, even leaving aside the government's ham-handed response to the second wave. It's just that we're not. I mean, forget if it's a Modi Shah thing. Yeah, this is a. And people will say, you're again blaming it on Nehru. No, I'm not blaming it on Nehru. Let's first look at the fact that we are a poor country. So we cannot compare our healthcare infrastructure to, in terms of public health, in terms of the population, to, let's say, Europe or even the US, which I honestly feel doesn't have a great healthcare system. Europe has a much better healthcare system. This is one of the things which I think US really sucks. In terms of, it's not that the healthcare system is bad, it's just overtly expensive, which actually makes it inaccessible more than bad. Anyways, but I think it just shows the systemic issues that we have with healthcare. And it's not just COVID, it's black fungus. We're just not built. We just do not have, and this, no matter what Modi had done. Again, this doesn't excuse what they should have done and they didn't. But even if they had done everything they could have, that would have definitely lessened the magnitude of the calamity, but we still wouldn't have been able to avoid it. I don't think so. Not what we see now in India. I don't think we were ever going to. We had a charmed life for the last year. I think when we say charmed, it's not just a question of luck. I've said this before. It was because the Modi government took a very unpopular but ultimately a great step, which was to put that very strong lockdown very early. That saved us for a year. But again, I don't want to repeat stuff that I've gone over in the previous podcasts. We all know how everything slipped. People became complacent, you know, and I also feel that in the US, the government has also become complacent by lifting every restriction. California is going to fully reopen. And I just feel it's too soon. It's too fast with different variants. Again, I understand the political compulsions, the economic compulsions, but I would have perhaps expected, and this is not just me speaking, some other people have said so too in America, that it would possibly a more phased, released, let's see how it goes. Let's loosen the tap a little bit, see how the water's flowing, let's do a little bit more. That would have perhaps made more sense than what Biden has done, which is essentially, or the CDC really, which is unfortunately, after Trump has become, and I see this in the Democratic administration too, has ultimately become a mouthpiece. I mean, these organizations in the US have traditionally been kind of independent in terms of their scientific advice, that they don't take pressure from politicians. They say what they have to say. But I think after Trump, that's no longer true. I believe the CDC now is also highly guided. And some people would say it's always been the case. And perhaps that's true. Maybe it's my naivete. But I think that what the CDC has now said, it's more based on political expediency. It's because, you know, people like the California governor, who's a major Democrat, future, you know, presidential hopeful, is facing a recall in California, which is essentially an off-schedule election because of the lockdown. So I think this is basically saving the behinds of many Democrat governors. That this is actually that's the reason, because of course the Democrats realize that just having the presidency in the U.S. doesn't give you a lot of control. The presidency is just one of the things. I mean, there's the House, there's the Senate, and then there are the states. So I think this has been driven more by political expediency than science. And again, I'm not the only person in the U.S. who's saying it. Once again, I'm not a doctor, so I wouldn't know. Anyways, moving from this to a certainly more, I don't know whether it's a more fun topic. It usually used to be a fun topic, but there have been, nowadays I've come to the stage in my life where nothing seems to be fun anymore. We had over the last, I don't know if any of you guys are following, I'm pretty sure some of you are following the story, that the US Pentagon and the Defense Department has for the first time in its history essentially said that yes, we have multiple sightings of UFOs. And 60 Minutes, which is a very old geriatric demographic. It's kind of, I would say, you know, it's people make jokes about the people who see 60 Minutes. I mean, they have their main theme is an old grandfather clock kind of clock going tick, 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 tick. So you can imagine how old that is, that people used to look at clock faces and see what the time was. So 60 Minutes ran, it's a very respected, venerable institution where, you know, it's not like Fox News or it's not like Rachel Maddow, that, you know, people, you know, you get onto 60 Minutes after people have like double, triple checked, quadruple checked your story. So there were multiple Air Force pilots and people from within the administration who said, yes, there have been multiple UFO sightings, and it's on YouTube. So for those of you interested in it, you should go and see it, where essentially, you know, pilots said that, you know, sometimes we were almost afraid of saying we had seen these things if we were in the sky alone, because people would then doubt our sanity, because we have seen stuff that, you know, and there are multiple pilots who are saying this, that we have seen stuff. And there is also like scientific data that there's video of that also. But we have seen stuff that, you know, I wouldn't believe possible. So I think one of them said, you know, aircraft, you know, those flying objects doing 58 to 60 Gs. And it would crush anything else. Stuff flying without any control surfaces or wings. No propulsion, no energy source coming out of it. So these are, again, almost against the laws of, I wouldn't say against the laws of physics, but these are not possible based on what we know science is. So they said, you know, there was a question that was asked, is this something which, you know, Russia has or China has? And they said, well, some of this technology is like 100 years, we might be 1,000 years behind. That's all I can say about these things. I mean, I don't think these are terrestrial technologies. And, you know, they have followed these aircraft or whatever they are, UFOs, and these UFOs have totally mimicked their flight path. And then two of them said, and there are multiple people who saw it, that it just vanished. Again, we all know that there's no technology that we have, except in our imaginations, that could make any object vanish. So it's obviously it has some kind of cloaking device also. So again, an explanation could be that these are all man-made, but, you know, if there was any hope that this would be man-made, was destroyed when Obama, who was the president, came and said, yeah, I mean, we've known this for some time, that there have been UFOs, and yeah, there doesn't seem to be terrestrial. And this is Obama saying, and yesterday somebody asked Biden, and he was obviously very disturbed by the question, because I don't think it's officially the US government. I mean, the Pentagon has, but I don't think the president, there's no president. By the way, Trump never said anything but he did start the Space Force, which people at that point of time thought was strange. But now perhaps it makes sense that there are, and again, with maybe a few years ago, I would have been excited, or aliens, if you're gonna, but nowadays I look at anything that is out of normal, and this is after the COVID-19 thing, and I just see it as not as something exciting or new, but as something which is dangerous and might end us all. So again, they said these aircraft has been there for years. They don't engage with us at all. And in that, and there was an interesting interview with Chris Cuomo on CNN with one of these pilots, or not with one of the pilots, but one of these, you know, head honchos in the Defense Department, who was actually the whistleblower. So he asked them that, you know, I know that, you know, the people will think that we've reached the bottom of journalism by even talking about aliens on prime time. But so I'm saying these things, and there's a part of me which is saying, what am I saying? But I have this question. If they actually are aliens, why haven't they talked to us? If they have been coming here for decades and they have all this advanced technology, why don't they talk to us? And I think this guy said, do you go to a zoo and talk to an animal? To them, we are animals. So they don't have any need. There's nothing we can tell them that they don't know. So there's no need for them to communicate. And I thought, well, that's well put. So coming to this, to the last topic for today, which was the Bengal elections, I'd been wanting to discuss this for a while. And again, I was surprised that Trinamool won so big. I didn't expect it to be this big. But as I had consistently said in my podcast, I didn't see BJP winning. What my prediction was that maybe they would come close, BJP would be a close second, Trinamool. My outside possibility was Trinamool might have to take help of Indian Secular Front or CPM. Maybe they'll get a few seats and that will tip them over. But mostly I thought they would get a majority. I didn't think this majority would be so overwhelming, that the mandate would be so overwhelming. And I think this comes down to multiple failures of BJP that was very obvious. Again, these were things which I had mentioned in my podcast. I think one of the biggest problems, and this I think the BJP figured out in the Delhi elections also, is that it's very different when in a state election versus central elections. So in a central elections, it's Modi versus a blank spot. So when you have Modi versus a blank spot, that then becomes very difficult for people, because it's consistently maintained that people don't vote based on data. They vote based on emotion. The vast majority vote based on emotion. So they're not looking at GDP numbers. They're not looking at adoption of Swasthya Sathi. They're not looking at, you know, where Bengal ranks in the list of Human Development Index. Nobody looks at those things. And they discuss about those things, but it's basically an emotional connect they have. And one of the big problems in any state election is, and the BJP does that, so it works in some places and it doesn't work in some places, is that they need to have, at the state level, they needed to have somebody who could counter the emotional connect that Mamata Banerjee has, especially with women voters in Bengal. And as I said, they had, and I think there's nobody in BJP has accepted this, but I think their main thing was it was going to be Saurav Ganguly, and Saurav Ganguly would pose a tough personality battle against Mamata Banerjee. Now, since that didn't pan out, I mean, going with Mithun Chakravarti was a terrible, terrible idea. And this comes to the second point, was that the BJP just, besides Dilip Ghosh, who is the only original that they have, the original homegrown BJP leader that they had, you know, taking the worst of Trinamool Congress, and that includes Mithun Chakravarti, this person who I respect respect, make fun of, whatever it is, I'm fond of him in different ways as a movie star, but as a politician, he represents, you know, the exact thing that, you know, if you're coming in with an agenda of change and about 80% of your leadership is exactly the same as the old party, not only that, the disgraced, ejected part of the old party, people who were refused seats because their original party thought they were that they wouldn't win, and they were right. Most of these people lost. And, you know, when you decide to go with this crowd, you basically take anti-incumbency on yourself. So you're doing two things. First of all, you're taking the anti-incumbency of Trinamool Congress on yourself by fielding these discredited leaders. Because, and this comes from, I think, BJP's almost undue haste. So in a way, if you take a step back, the BJP has done well. It's gone for 2 or 3 seats to 73 seats, which is a huge increase. Now, but it seems like a defeat because the BJP's objective was to win this thing. And this is what happens when you try to grow too quickly. I think one of the problems with Amit Shah Modi's overall growth strategy of BJP is it's just way too aggressive. They expect things to happen fast. They expect things to happen within a year. And sometimes it does happen. And this happens in personal life too. You know, sometimes you do get double promoted. Sometimes you buy a cryptocurrency and it shoots up. But you cannot expect that to be replicated continuously. It just doesn't happen. So with respect to Bengal, I think one of the biggest problems that BJP has in terms of its overall strategy is that they wanted to win Bengal now. There was really very little that he could have even done, even if they had Ganguly, perhaps, to have won. It took Mamata Banerjee decades to get to where she was. So even if the BJP accelerates, it will still require 10 years for them, I would say, for them to have. And I think they have started on the wrong foot by taking in the worst of Trinamool Congress. I mean, yes, they do have their support bases, but is that what you want in your party? Is that the message? Is that the emotional connect that you want people to make? You don't. In many places, what happened was that the Trinamool Congress fielded candidates who were the people who were actually intimidating, injuring, in many cases, killing the BJP activists a few months ago. And then they gave those guys the BJP ticket. So how do you expect the BJP, what will a BJP cadre, what will be a committed BJP cadre do then? What can they do at that point of time? How do you even, I mean, so this, again, this is happening because the BJP in its real hurry to win things is actually, I think, shooting itself in the foot by aligning themselves with the worst of Trinamool, because they believe, hey, these guys come with their own gundas, they come with their own support base, they come with their own voting blocks. No, they don't actually. Because many of their voting blocks, it's not theirs only. It's kind of a joint ownership with Mamata Banerjee. And when they split, it's not that they can bring their full voting block with them. So even that calculation doesn't work. So BJP would have been much better. It would have been much better for the BJP to actually create their own cadre. They might not have gone from 3 to 73. They might have even gone from 3 to 50. But they still would have a better chance moving forward. I think the BJP at this point of time, I don't see where the BJP is going to go forward. Now that they have, no matter how much they spin it, it's a defeat for them. So are they going to go with, you know, Lockett Chatterjee, Rupa Ganguly, Babul Supriyo, are they going to go with, and Dilip Ghosh? These are the, I would say, that at least some of the names that they have been consistently been BJP. So are they going to go with these people? Are they going to go with the old loyalists? Or are they going to throw their lot with Shubhendu Adhikari and Mukul Roy and these people and say that this is going to be the future of the party? We are going to take the the discarded elements of Trinamool Congress and we are going to basically make them into BJP activists. But whatever it is, it will be interesting to see. I think the BJP took a gamble. They wanted to grow very fast. And I think they saw that in Bengal, you can't do that. I think the fact that many of these, I mean, the BJP threw every resource they had at this election. But again, the fact is, if you have campaigners coming from outside of the state talking in Hindi, in Bengal, it kind of, and the other party using that as an election and saying these people are outsiders, they don't even speak your language, they're not even Bengalis. You know, these things do matter. These things do matter. So many people who otherwise would possibly have voted against Mamata Banerjee, and there is, at least in my personal circle, there are many people who would. But when the choice was between Mamata Banerjee and somebody who didn't even speak Bengali, then they would say, okay, I'll go with the person who at least speaks my language. I'll go with the person who at least knows, you can recognize, let's say, Rabindranath Tagore from somebody else, or, you know, somebody who has some knowledge, or, you know, in case of Bengal, which is very, very important, I said many years ago, was the whole vegetarianism thing and the meat eating thing. You know, people, there's a fear that this is going to lead to aggressive vegetarianism. So these things are very, very emotional things. The fish is an emotional thing for a Bengali. So coupled with the fact that there is no homegrown daughter of the soil or son of the soil, and it's Mithun Chakravarti, who's Bengali, but, you know, he's kind of been outside the state for many years and nobody really sees him. And I mean, he's good for, you know, some dialogue bazi and stuff, and people will come to see him, but nobody takes him seriously. They take Sourav Ganguly seriously, yes, as a leader and as like what he has achieved. People take him seriously as a leader. But Mithun Chakravarti, nobody takes him seriously as a leader. He's the guy you go to listen to, he will give dialogues and stuff. But, you know, even if you ask a guy, you know, can you imagine Mithun Chakravarti as your chief minister? They will say, no, not Mithun Chakravarti. So in Mithun Chakravarti's role was, I didn't understand what was going on. And maybe he wouldn't have been the chief minister, maybe Shubhendu Adhikari would have been the chief minister if they had won. But I also don't think that, you know, even if you have Shubhendu Adhikari, I think there are a lot of people who might be against Trinamool Congress and against Mamata Banerjee, but they would definitely not vote for Shubhendu Adhikari. And so I think this is something which the BJP has to work out. Again, I think they need a brain trust which is anchored in Bengal. I think Kailash Vijayawargiya, they might be all good for the central elections. And many people in Bengal, they make the distinction, like other people in the country, that Modi versus there is no alternative. At least before COVID, that was essentially the common sentiment. This is why Modi has been winning again and again with increasing returns. But at the state, that's not true. It was another thing. The problem was flipped around. And so I think that was the reason why ultimately BJP lost. Anyways, so we've reached the end for this podcast. Everybody stay well, stay safe, wear your masks, practice social distancing, try to get vaccinated, and I'll see you next week. Bye-bye for now.